chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. Let me explain what I'm up to now, in case you're wondering why I'm going back to chapter 40. Chapter 40 commences a new section of Isaiah, and in that section, it's the section which deals with the servant of the Lord, and many of the passages which relate to the Lord appear, the Lord Jesus and his ministry and his suffering appear in this section from chapter 40 onwards. It's called we'd call it the Messianic section of Isaiah. And so I want to just look at the introduction of this, first of all, to get some flavor of this section of the book. Now, let me do something I didn't say I would do last night, but perhaps I ought to do it just to put this in the picture. Isaiah has 66 chapters, like a Bible in itself, isn't it? 66 chapters. And it can be divided in various ways, but the main way of dividing it is this way. You can divide it into halves. That is to say that you can look at from chapter 1 to chapter 39 as one half of the book. The gospel chapters are a historical commentary on what has happened and what is stated in the previous chapters. And the thing which dominates those chapters from chapter 1 to 39 is the theme of condemnation and retribution. Condemnation, retribution upon nations, and of course ultimately upon Israel, upon Judah, and upon the king in the last chapters of that section. And what you're dealing with in that particular part of the book is God's government. How he governs the nations, how he acts in them, what he's going to do with Eden, what he's going to do with Assyria, what he's going to do with Syria, what he's going to do with Babylon. And you've got God's government being portrayed. And the theme is the judgment of God. God is judging nations, and you get this picture coming out in this particular half of the book. Then you come to chapter 40, and chapter 40 starts with the word comfort, tied to what's going to be happening in this section. And in chapter 40 onwards, one of the things which predominates is the restoration of Israel. And so you have another section which doesn't deal, as in the first section, with condemnation and retribution, but it deals with consolation and restoration. So it deals with that sort of those major themes. And whereas the first part is God's government in view, this now is God's grace. And his grace comes out in chapter 40 beautifully. Comfort ye my people. And you've got the picture of a shepherd who carries the lambs in his bosom. And the picture is one of God's grace. And whereas the first section dealt with the judgment of God, this deals with the comfort of God. Now, the hinge on which this all moves is chapter 36-39. And so some have looked at it in this way, that the first section, 1 to 35, is a prophetical section, general, which deals with Israel, Judah, and all the other nations around about. And scattered in this are also some nuggets of pictures of the coming Christ. But it's generally a prophetical section. Then you've got this historical interlude of four chapters which deal with something in some events in the reign of Hezekiah. And then you start chapter 40. And chapter 40, you don't go far into chapter 40 before a person appears called the servant of the Lord. And he will dominate the chapters. Of course, he's the Messiah. And so this is the messianic passage of the book. And it's interesting to notice how it starts. Comfort, my people. And so that is first of all, the rough breakdown. I want to come back later on when we're looking at 53 to see how these 40 chapters break down, because there is a very significant way in which they are divided. But having said that, let's now read in chapter 40. And what I'm going to do is start at verse 12, because great as this chapter is, I haven't time to go through it all, so we're going to look at verse 12 and go from there. Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and meted out heaven with a span, comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor, hath taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed him to him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, and accounted as a small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare unto him? The workman melteth, graven image, and the goldsmith spreadeth over it with gold, casteth silver chains. He that is so impoverished, he hath no oblation, chooseth a tree, and will not rot. Seeketh unto him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. Have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof as grasshoppers, stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain, and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in, and bringeth the princes to nothing, maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they shall not be planted. Yea, they shall not be sown. Yea, they stock shall not take root in the earth, and he shall also blow upon them, and they shall wither, and the whirlwind shall take them away as stubble. To whom then will you liken me, or shall I be equal? Saith the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high. Behold, who hath created these things, that bringeth out their host by number? He calleth them all by names for the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, and not one faileth. What sayest thou, O Jacob, and speakest, O Israel? My way is hid from the Lord. My judgment is passed over from my God. Hast thou not known? Hast thou not heard? That the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary, no searching of his understanding? He giveth power to the faint, and to them that hath no might, he increaseth strength. Even the youth shall faint, and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fail. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. Shall mount up with wings as eagles, run not be weary, they shall walk and not faint. Now, it is possible for us, in the dark moments which come in our life, and dark moments sometimes do come, it's possible for us to so be obsessed with our lot in life that we lose sight of the greatness and sovereignty of our God. That was a possibility which is open to these Jews. They were going to be taken into captivity. They weren't in captivity yet. They would be taken into captivity. There are some who look at these chapters as being written after the captivity. Well, that's not so. This is a prophetic statement which the writer is making in these chapters. But when they were in captivity, they could look back to this chapter, and it could bring some comfort to them if they gazed upon the God who was found in this chapter. And so what the prophet is doing here is he is drawing our thoughts, and he is concentrating our thoughts upon the greatness and the majesty of our God, so that we should know how great our God is. And what I want to do this morning now is to just analyze this chapter, that we've read, and consider now the greatness of the God who's going to act within these pages from chapter 40 onwards. Now, it is possible to break the chapter, in this part of the chapter, into three little sections dealing with the majesty of God. Let's now look at how it can be done. First of all, when you read from verse 12, and you read down to verse 20, you will read a passage which deals with God's majesty in relation to the earth. Notice how it starts. It talks of him measuring out the waters, weighing the mountains, and so on. And so you are talking of nations and land masses and mountains and so on here. And you are dealing with the majesty of God in relation to the earth. Now, when you go in further on to verse 21, you will then notice that the viewpoint is now from heaven. See, here's somebody who sits on the circle of the earth. He's above it. Verse 22 tells us that. And he's looking down upon the earth and the inhabitants are as grasshoppers. And he stretches up the heavens as a curtain. And so on. And so it's talking of the greatness of God from a heavenly standpoint. The greatness of God in the heavens. And then when you look at verse 27, he now directly addresses his own people. What are you saying, Jacob, and what are you saying, Israel? They were grumbling, of course, at this particular point. They were saying, my way is hid from the Lord, and my judgment is passed over from my God. He doesn't care. And so he is now directly addressing his people, and his majesty is seen in relation to his people. So you get the response from God. How do you know that the everlasting God, the Lord, that, well, there you go, you see, it's all his majesty. And he's going to tell it in relation to his people. He's the God who has strength and power. He's the God who's prepared to impart that strength and power to his own, so that they might run, not be weary, walk, not faint, rise up the thing, like eagles. And so that strength and power which he has, he's able to impart to these people who are dejected, because they think that their way is hidden from God. So those then are the three divisions we want to look at, and I see how far we can get through them. Let's look first of all then at them. And what we're going to do in looking at these is we're going to pick out some of the attributes of God. And that's all we're going to do. Now look at some of the attributes of God as they're seen here. Now chapter 40 of the prophecy of Isaiah talks about God, and it seems to have two sections. Up to verse 11, it talks of the tenderness of his attitudes. So it starts with, comfort ye, comfort ye, my people. And the picture which predominates in that section is of a shepherd who is so tender that the little lambs who can't keep up the pace, he picks them up and puts them in his bosom. And the nursing ewes which find it difficult to maintain the movement of the flock, he stops and he waits for them to catch up. And you get the picture of the tenderness in the attitude of our God. But when you come to this section, you're dealing with worlds and universe and heavens which he spreads just like a tent curtain. And what you're dealing with now is not the tenderness of our God in his attitudes, but you're dealing with the transcendence of our God in his attributes. And so what we want to look at is this picture of God and his attributes and the transcendence of them. And you get that picture again and again in this section, because he says to them, who are you going to like me to? Who are you going to compare me to? And he's challenging them. And he knows, of course, that he's so transcendent that there's no possibility of even comparing him to anything else other than himself. So let's now look at the passage and see, and pick them out, and as we go through them, as fast as we can, and see if we can get through to the end of the chapter. First of all then, and we're talking now of his majesty in relation to the earth. And let's look at verses 12 where we started. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured out heaven with a span, comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales, hills in a balance. And he's asking them the question, just as in the book of Job he asked Job the same sort of questions. And then you notice down in verse 15, nations are a drop of a bucket, and they are counted as small dust of the balance. Take us up the aisles as a very little thing. What's he talking about? He is telling us, first of all here, that God is omnipotent. That's what he's telling us. You see, the greatness of God here is illustrated by the magnitude, the greatness of his action. That's what he's doing. He's saying what he's doing. And his greatness is being illustrated by the magnitude of his actions as creator. And he's asking these questions to bring home to puny mind of men and the puny activities and capabilities of mere man, the contrast and the comparison with the mighty power of the creator. Now, for you and me, the universe is immeasurable. I mean, if the astronomers haven't will admit that, they know that they're even beyond what they can see, there's still more. And it's immeasurable. Not, however, for God. It's not immeasurable. The verses tell us of the impotence of man. But they also tell us how powerful God is. Remember, says Isaiah, that, you know, your God is so great. And the language is anthropomorphic. You know, that means it speaks of God in human terms. He says, remember that your God is so great that he holds the ocean as a drop in the hollow of a man's hand. Now, when I came here last Saturday, I came to the United States, it took me maybe 9 hours to get to Miami, because, of course, you had to cross the ocean, the Atlantic. That's only one of them, of course. There are a few more oceans around as well. But when you think of that vast quantity of water, and, says the writer, you know, just a drop in his hand, that's all it is. Just a drop in his hand. And so he's drawing the picture of the contrast. Now, he goes on down in verse 15 and he says, what are the nations? Oh, really, a drop in the bucket. All these nations, they're just a drop in the bucket. Just a single drop. And you know, how can a single drop splashing from a bucket limit God who carries the bucket? A drop in the bucket. And such is the estimate God places upon the nations. A drop which adds nothing to the burden of where the bearer feels. Nothing at all. So little are the nations and the land masses compared with our God. And then he says, well, you know, that's not all. You see, we can't measure the universe. But, you know, the span of God's hand measures the heavens. He measures from horizon to horizon without limitation. And what's more, he says, you know, think of his arms. He holds the scales. And you can put the highest mountains in those scales. And to him, it's just like dust in the scales of a merchant. And so, what he is emphasizing again and again here is the omnipotence of our God. How can the dust wiped off of the scale of a merchant carry any burden for the one who is referred to here? Now, the wonderful thing about it is, look, our God is so great. He's also very loving. And the thing which interests me is, and I'm thinking back in the earlier passage which we haven't looked at, is the comparison which comes out. Because the same hand which holds the oceans as a drop in the hollow of them also holds his sheep. And John 10 tells us that. And the same arm which supports the mighty mountains, that same arm encircles the lands, for he carries the lands in his bosom. Now, the Lord Jesus, when he wanted to display the greatness of God, he did it the opposite way, didn't he? This writer has taken the significant things which are to our minds significant. The Lord did the opposite, because this God is only concerned with the great things, but he's concerned with the infinitesimally small things. So the Lord said, see the lilies of the field? You know? God dresses those. See the sparrows? If one falls to the ground, God's taking note of it. He feeds them, you know. The hairs of your head? Well, now, perhaps the hairs of my head don't matter too much. And after Bob has got out, they matter less. But the fact is that he counts the numbers of hairs of your head. The small things. But what it is telling us is how great our God is. He's only concerned with the great things, but he has the capability of looking at the very minute things and be concerned with those. That's our God. He will not fail us, nor forsake us. Such a God is ours. He's omnipotent. Now, let's look at verse 13 and 14. Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, who being his counselor taught him, with whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, taught him knowledge, and showed him the way of understanding? So he's asking questions again. And he's saying, well, no one did. No one taught him counsel. No one taught him understanding. No one gave him knowledge. No one instructed him. No one taught him in the way of path of judgment. Why? Because this God is only omnipotent. He's omniscient. He doesn't need to be given counsel. He doesn't need to be taught. He is omniscient. He doesn't need the advice nor the help of men in running his universe. You know, there are no surprises for God. We get surprised. God doesn't. He doesn't have any surprises. He knows the end from the beginning. God doesn't have to resort to emergency action. He knows all that's going to happen. He doesn't need assistance from the external source. He's sovereign. He doesn't need no one to consult with because his wisdom is inexhaustible. His knowledge is self-derived. It isn't given to him. He knows all things. And he foresees all things. And he always knows what the next event is going to be, and his wisdom is unsearchable. Our God is omniscient. Let's go on a bit further and have another look to see what it says. Verse 17. Let's go to verse 16. And leaven is not sufficient to burn, nor the beasts thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him as nothing. And they accounted to him less than nothing. Well, I mean, that's less than nothing. And vanity. What's he saying here? God is omnipotent. God is omniscient. What's he saying here? He's talking about sacrifice. He's talking about a tremendous sacrifice. Here. He's picturing it, of course. And what he's saying is, you know, God is all worthy. It doesn't matter what sacrifice you bring to him. He's even more worthy than the biggest sacrifice you can bring. God is all worthy. Now, he's going to describe it in physical terms. And so what he says is this. Now, we've got Lebanon here, he says. Now, Lebanon is quite a nation, adjoining the land at the present. And if those of you know anything about it will know that there are huge mountains in Lebanon. In fact, they go 9,000 feet, they call the Lebanese Alps. So you've got quite a high escarpment of land in Lebanon. You rise up from the coastal plain into the valley which leads you up eventually to Baalbek at the end, and there are mountains on your side which go up to 9,000 feet. So you've got quite a big landmass. And he's thinking of that. And then, of course, at this time, and still to some extent, Lebanon was covered in forests, not less than it used to be. But he says, you know, if Lebanon were a great earthen altar, so you've got a great earthen altar which goes up to 9,000 feet to start off, you know, and that's what they would have known. They would have known that was in their area, you see. And then he says, you get all the trees in Lebanon and out of the forests, and you put all those on top of the altar. And you bring all the cattle of Lebanon, and you make a massive burnt offering. Do you know if you did that, it's not too extravagant for this God. You know, that's how he's trying to picture it. You even did that. So great is our God, that the greatest offerings we could make to him, our greatest sacrifices, our greatest gifts of self-denial, which cost us most, are not too great for him. The presentation of ourselves is still just a reasonable service, though we present it as living, our bodies as living sacrifices. You see, for us, our debt to God is so great that no conceivable sacrifice which we could make could be not too great to make for him. He's trying to indicate the greatness of God by the fact that any sacrifice which was made by men could be insufficient for this God. Now, what is sacrifice? Now, there's a lovely definition of what sacrifice is, and I will quote it to you, because it gripped me when I read it, and it is. Sacrifice is the ecstasy of giving the best we have to the one we love the most. Lovely, isn't it? The ecstasy of giving the best we have to the one we love most. And if we did that, it still would not be finally worthy of our God. Now, having said that, I need to point out, of course, that there is in the prophecy of Isaiah a sacrifice which is worthy of God. And we will come to that when we read the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. Our God is all worthy. Now let's go on to verse 17, 18, and 25 and pick these up. All nations before him are as nothing, counted as to him as less than nothing, and vanity. And then he's got this picture of the idol maker. Verse 18 says, to whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare unto him? And you then have this man who makes an idol. And then verse 25, to whom then will you liken me, or to whom shall I be equal? Notice what the chapters are saying. Who are you going to liken me to? And twice God asks the question, verse 18 and verse 25. Who's going to be my equal? Who are you going to liken me to? Who's going to be my equal? And what God is saying here is this. God is incomparable. You can't compare him with anyone else. He's incomparable. Now, notice the phrase in verse 17, all nations before him. And the phrase before him has the meaning of in relation to him, in comparison to what he is. So all nations, all men, comprising those nations, in comparison to him, are what? Nothing. Counted to less than nothing. And are emptiness. So there's nothing then, we are told here, with which God can be compared. For he is the creator, and all that there is his creation, the work of his hands. So having made that comment, the writer then goes on to tell us how utterly futile idolatry is. And he goes on to give this little picture in the verses which follow of a man who goes out and he's going to make an idol. So he picks, actually the rich man gets a man to do it for him and comes with his gold. But the poor man goes out and he goes into the forest, chooses wood, and brings it home and he carves it and so on. And the glory which it will have is only the glory which the workman will give it. And Isaiah is saying this a little bit with his tongue in his cheek, because when he brings this idol home and he's made it, even though he's been careful in choosing a wood which will not rot, and he's got a cunning workman to prepare it, what happens is that he has to make it in such a way that it won't topple on its base, so it will not be moved. The picture you've got is this guy who goes out and chooses this wood very carefully, gets a skilled craftsman to make it, and at the end of the day, he's got to make a base sufficient to support it, otherwise it will topple over. What a thing to worship, he's saying. How ridiculous to worship such a thing as that. And so the poor man bows down to it, and he worships that instead of worshipping the immutable God. What's happening? The temporal is trying to create the eternal. The finite is trying to create the infinite. The changeable is trying to create the unchangeable. And man is always seeking to create God in his own image, in the image of man. And it's futile. And so the writer has asked the question, who are you going to compare me to? And he surely can't say, I can't compare him to the idol. But even the nations you can't compare him to. And men are before him, his creation. The creator is incomparable. So God is incomparable. Now verse 18. Again, to whom will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare unto him? Now, this is telling us something else as well here, and it is telling us that our God is not only incomparable, but our God is sovereign. And I say that because again we have a word which I referred to last night, and it's the word which is used for God here, and it's El, E-L. The title is used for God, E-L. And when God is used, when the title for God is used in that way, it is indicating someone who has power and dominion over all. It indicates a God of dominion and power. Now let's have a look first of all and see what this book explains it to us as, this particular title. Go back to chapter 40, go on now, chapter 42. Verse 5. Thus saith God, El, the Lord. He that created the heavens and stretched them out, he that spread forth the earth, and which all cometh out of it, and so on. What's it telling us? It's telling us here in this picture that God, El, has power and dominion over all things. Created all things. So he has power and dominion over all things. Go on to chapter 43 and pick up the word again. Verse 10 of chapter 43. Before me, the end of the verse, chapter 10, before me there was no God. Form, neither shall there be after me. It's the same word which is used. Verse 12. And he said, I have declared, I have said, I have showed that there is no strange God among you, therefore ye are my witnesses, saith the Lord, that I am God. Go to chapter 46 and verse 9 of chapter 46. And you'll notice in verse 9 of chapter 46, again he says, for I am God and there is none else. I am God and there is none like me. And it's the same word which is used. And what he is saying is that he alone is God. He's claiming absolute deity. So the title means absolute deity. That's what he's claiming. And then go to chapter 45 and notice how he brings this down now to be relevant to the people he's writing to. And verse 14. Thus, we've got the end of the chapter, or the end of the verse of verse 14 of chapter 45. Surely God, that's the same word, is in thee. And there is none else, there is no God. So this God who is unique, who is absolute, who has power and dominion, he is saying to Israel, well, he's your God. He's in you. And verse 15 will tell us, finally, of that particular chapter, in very light of God, that hidest thyself, O God of Israel. And he's telling us that the same God is inscrutable. We cannot tell his ways. So here then, in that picture, is a picture of a God who is solitary, who is unique, in every aspect of his character. And that's why I say when I look at this, that God is sovereign, is a sovereign God. So much then for his majesty in relation to the earth, his majesty in relation to the heavens. And we're looking now at verse 21 down to verse 26. So what's he doing here then? Well, there are questions, of course, asked these people. Didn't they understand? Didn't they understand that God was the creator of the earth? Didn't they understand that? Hadn't they been told them that God had created all things? And so Isaiah sees God seated, verse 22, upon the circle of the earth. Now, it's a figurative expression for God upholding and maintaining creation in his providential dealings. And so he's seated there as a king, constantly upholding his creation, sustaining it, keeping it, and governing it. And as he looks down from heaven upon men, men appear simply as grasshoppers. So God is looking down upon men and he sees them as grasshoppers. You know, one antidote to fear, which the prophet is almost implying here, is this. One antidote to fear is to sit in the heavenlies with God and see things from God's standpoint. And he looks down upon earth and he sees men as grasshoppers. He sees the rulers as ones he can blow upon, and he blows them away. And if we sit in the heavenlies and let God be our standpoint and not man, then our views of things might well change. But he continues, and what he says is, God not only has created the earth, but he's created the heavens. And so notice verse 22, that stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. And so what he says he does is he stretches out the heavens just like the fabric of a tent. In fact, like the fabric of the curtain of the tent. Just like that. And the tent itself is just for him to dwell. And he's trying to tell us again how great is our God. And so from this place, above the circle of the earth, God is controlling the events of the universe, spreading out the heavens, dwelling in them as a tent. And if creation is his tent in which he dwells, how puny man must seem in relation to that. And if that is our God, should we fear? Even the actions of the greatest of men
the potentates of earth.
Our God is greater. Now, notice something more. It's not that he simply presides over the universe and stretches out the heavens like a curtain of a tent, but he also provides over the history of men. And so notice what he goes on to say, verse 23, that brings the princes to nothing and makes the judges of the earth as vanity. It isn't just that he controls the material universe, but he also exercises lordship over men. Now, he gives princes over to nothingness. That is, he removes them from their position of power, so they have no power whatsoever. And he gives judges over to desolation, that's the word. That is, he places them in such a position that they couldn't act as judges. So he's controlling in the affairs of men. Verse 24 is a further point in this. Yea, they shall not be planted. Yea, they shall not be sown. Though the princes and judges were to be established in their position, God acts in such a way that they're removed. Neither the rulers do not ascend to the throne in their own power. So he says, you know, rulers have to be planted, trees have to be planted, seed have to be sown. So rulers have to be placed in their position. Judges have to be placed in their positions of authority and power. But then, having been placed in their positions of power, what happens? There they are, they're planted. There they are, they're sown. They look secure. And God comes along and he breathes on them, blows on them, and they're with it. They're finished. That's how great God is. Even the affairs of men, he can lift up and put down. I raise up the Chaldean, says he to Habakkuk. And that's what he did. They were planted and sown. And then he blew upon them. And in one night, the empire disappeared. See, that's our God. He rules in the kingdoms of men, rules over the universe. And there he sits upon the circle of the earth, and he looks down, and he controls it all. But then, when you come down to verse 27, now, when you come down to the next passage, it says verse 25. You notice it says something else. To whom then will you liken me, or shall I be equal? Now notice, saith the Holy One. Now, that little phrase is a phrase which occurs on in this book a number of times, and sometimes occurs in a longer form. The Holy One of Israel. And Isaiah uses that because he's learnt it. And he's learnt that God is the Holy One and the Holy One of Israel when he was commissioned in chapter 6. When the angelic being said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. So he's picked it up and he's the Holy One. But he's related to Israel in most passages. He's the Holy One of Israel. But what it is telling us is that he is the Holy One. That indicates that here is someone who is unassailable, unfailing, authoritative, purity, and holiness. Now, it's only God can possess the qualities that this chapter indicates, because God is holy. Now, when we talk of holiness, when we talk of God being holy, one of the ideas in that is that God is separate and distinguished from his creation and from his creatures. And he is separate in the sense in which this chapter is indicated. In all his powers which he exercises, he is so distinct from his creation that he is unique and holy. And then, again, verses 20 and 27 I wanted to get down to, and you'll notice that he talks of God as being the upholder and preserver of all things. Verse 26, lift up your eyes on high. Behold, who hath created these things, bringeth forth thy host by number, call them all by names, and the greatness of his might, that he is strong in power, not one faileth. So here he is speaking again of God as a upholder and preserver of all things. Notice the phrase here in this little section, not one of them faileth. Now he's talking about God's vast universe. And God holds that universe in such equilibrium, the prophet says, you know, not one is out of place. Not one failed. You must notice what the prophet says. First of all, lift up your eyes on high. You know, man was formed by God to contemplate the heavens. See, when God created man and other creatures, all other creatures looked downwards. But man alone he created to be erect and to look up. And God created man erect. And when man, in all seriousness, contemplates the heavens, looks up, he sees the heavens, which are the work of God's hand. They are his handiwork. Now, the prophet then is asked us to look up. And he's now talking about the heavens, and he's talking about the starry heavens. And he says, well, look, lift up your eyes on high and behold those things which he's created. So we're looking up and there's the stars and the heavens above us. And God has created them. And he says, well, you know, they're innumerable to man. We can't number them. But God knows their number. And he knows their name. Notice what he says here. He says, that bringeth out their host by number. He knows their number. And he calls them by name. He got them all by name. So, well, you look up and see God's handiwork in the heavens. Remember that our God calls them out. And he knows them all by name. And there are more than you and I could ever imagine. But something else here about this, the picture which he has is of God as a commander, great commander. And he's calling them up by rank. You notice what it says here in the verse, that brings out their host, brings forth their host. Now that particular phrase, bring forth, is a military term. When you read the history of David, 2 Samuel 5, they made David king, and they said, you are he who led us out and brought us in. Of course, it's a military term. They're talking of David's exploits when he led out Israel to battle, and they sang David's fame, Saul's fame is thousands, and David's tens of thousands. They were looking back to that. So he led them out in battle, brought them back in. And that's the word which is used here. And he's talking about God as a commander, and he leads out his host. You look at the stars, and there they are. It's a picture, a metaphor which this writer is using to explain the greatness of God. And they are there by the greatness of his might, for he is strong in power. And so this host of God, these stars, the stellar universe, serve God by declaring his glory. That's what the psalmist said to us. They show forth his handiwork. Now, God keeps every one of them in his appointed place. Night after night, above the horizon, they rise. They roll on their pathway, as the psalmist would think, as we roll on, of course. But they are there, in their place, maintained by the act of a sovereign, omnipotent God. That begs the question, doesn't it? You see, Surely an intelligible creation must have an intelligent source. Surely a universe in which mind can comprehend order and number must have at the back of it a mind which created it. And Scripture bids us to think of God not just with his creative energy. God who sets all things in motion and allows the universe to spin at will. No. What the Scripture is telling us here is that this God who is our God is a divine person who brought all things into being, but then he operates in that universe and he's a sustaining cause of it. He upholds all things by the word of his power. Even now, the universe is in perfect equilibrium because of the word of our God. And so he's saying that God is the preserver and upholder. What a contrast to this. See, everything in the heavens is punctual and in order and obedient, whilst below there's self-will, which takes a person into a track in which they become wandering stars. to whom is reserved the darkness, blackness of darkness forever. Now, finally, God's mercy in relation to his own. And we're looking now at God's, at the passage, verse 27 to 31. So he addresses Jacob, Israel, addresses the nation. And what he is saying is this, what Israel is saying, let's get that first. Israel is saying, well, God has forgotten us. Our way is hid from the Lord. Our judgment is passed over from our God. God has forgotten all about it. And what the prophet is trying to do is to correct that idea. God is not only the creator, he's the preserver of all things, and he's indicated that. And so he is saying, look, if God is the preserver of all things, the sustainer of all things, how can you say that he's forgotten you? How can you say that he's forsaken you? Now, the creator knows the stars, knows every atom in his universe. Can he be accused of forgetting his people? This is the sort of question which the writer has in mind when he comes here with these questions. Now, this was Israel's complaint, and sometimes it's our complaint when difficulty and adversity come to us. God forgotten? Where's God in these circumstances? Question which no doubt many people ask in September the 11th. Well, God is still on the throne. God is very angry. But it's a question which comes naturally to people's minds who don't know him, and it comes to the mind of these particular people here of Israel and Judah. It's a continual complaint that mankind makes. Where is God? Back in Wales, in the 60s, when my two children were tiny, they came running in one day and said, "Mummy, Daddy, have you seen what's happened?" We didn't have a television, so we didn't see what had happened. But there was a little school. There's an assembly in the morning. "Jesus, thou tender shepherd, lead us." It was the last hymn they sung, and it was the last hymn they ever sung. Because the mountain behind them moved and came crashing into the school, and 200 small children were killed. The whole children of a village, with the exception of one or two who were sick, was wiped out, the whole generation. People said, "Well, where's God?" There's a problem for Christians. Of course, you see, the tendency is that we tend to attribute sometimes to God actions which are attributable to the greed and schemes of men. And in this particular case, it was a man-created mountain which had been made because men wanted to save money and wanted to make the most money they possibly could, and they built the mountain upon a stream which washed away its foundation. God wasn't responsible for that. But this is something which people can say and to make and attack our God on this. And it was in the case here of Israel and Judah that they were making a complaint. They didn't believe that God cared for them, that he was missing when he was needed. And he neglects our cause, they say. Notice what they say. My way. That's my path through life. My lot in life. My circumstances. And they feel that their adverse lot has been overlooked by Jehovah. And then they say, well, you know, we want to have God indicate that our judgment is right, but he's forgotten that. He's not saying that we're right. He's passed over that. Our God's forgotten us. And then comes the answer. No, God hasn't done that. Why are you saying that? Verse 28. Hast thou not known, hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, faints not, neither is weary. There is no searching of his understanding to, he giveth power to the faint, to them that have no might, he increaseth with strength. So what the prophet is saying is this, look, you made the wrong inference. God is transcendent, and he's been describing that all the way through. But the wrong inference to draw is this, that because God is so great, because he is transcendent, he's too great to care. That's the wrong inference to draw. The right inference is this, that our God is too great to fail. Not to care. He's too great to fail. What folly to think that way, says Isaiah. God is such that you need never doubt his capacity. And so here comes the final attribute which he is making of God. And he's saying, you know, our God is immutable. He doesn't change. Repeat things he already said. Why does he do that? Because God does not change. He is immutable. Others may change. I am the God, says the Lord to Malachi. I am the God that change not. All things might be wrapped up, says the writer of the Hebrews, but you remain. You're the same. You haven't changed. We have a Savior who's Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, and today, and forever. He never changes. Doesn't suffer from weariness, doesn't suffer from exertion. And let me summarize very quickly the last few verses. So they were feeling that God had forgotten them. They were feeling weak and faint. And what he says is this, but this is a God of power. And he's described all that, of course, already for us, hasn't he? He indicates that here in the passage, verse 26. He is strong in power. And he's been telling us all the way through. Then he says, look, you faint-hearted. You think that God has forgotten you? He's not forgotten you, he doesn't fail. But I tell you what, this God of power can impart to you who are faint and weak, he can impart that same power to you. For notice what it says now in verse 29. Verse 26, he is strong in power. Verse 29, he gives power. That's it. To who? Power to those who wait upon the Lord. Power to rise up as eagles when the adrenaline is flowing and things greater to be done. To run in the crises of life when things have to be trailed a bit more steadily. And to walk when we have to cope with a monotonous round of life, which perhaps is the most difficult thing to do. He gives us the power in every circumstance. That same power which is his, which holds the ocean in the hollow of his hand and sustains the mountains as small dust in the vast. How great is our God. Let's break, shall we? I've gone over time. Again, obviously failing this time. So we have a break, but I think it has to be shorter because the vibrating of